latest episode of My Imaginary University, which this time sees Ben Tucker, who's a partner at Minerva, one of the sector's search consultancies, creating an exciting new university, some distance from the UK, in Kerala in India. Originally titled Preposterous University, things quickly got a little more serious, and Kerala Leadership University was founded, with a very broad-based curriculum and a strong widening participation ethos, as well as big fundraising ambitions. It's a functional rather than a glitzy campus, no lazy rivers here, and there's an ongoing debate about students wearing uniform. It's also a pretty egalitarian place, with a triumvirate, or possibly quadrumvirate, in charge instead of a heroic vice-chancellor, and an intentionally unruly senate. There is little regard here for league tables, and no distinction between academic and professional services staff. Very novel, that. The student experience is a positive and community-focused one, and the university is ready for both a rolling programme of student-determined bans on things and also expected demands for free condoms. The Kerala environment is believed to be an open and progressive one, although the support of both local politicians and donors might be tested by the idea of an annual Karl Marx Day. Ben suggests a couple of alternatives for university mascots and offers some uplifting options for the big university anthem to be played at graduation. KLU certainly represents a novel approach to higher education in India, and I'm sure you'll enjoy hearing about Ben's imaginary university. Right, well, it's my huge pleasure this time on My Imaginary University, the podcast that gives notable sector figures the opportunity to create their own fictional higher education institution. It's my enormous pleasure to welcome Ben Tucker, who's a partner at Minerva, one of the sector's premier search consultancies. So welcome, Ben. It's great to see you.
Thanks, Paul. Good to speak to you too.
And you're someone who's had vast experience over many years in higher education. So I'm hoping you will take the opportunity to create, you know, a very new and interesting kind of institution for us. But let's start then straight away in learning what kind of imaginary university you've created. What's it like?
So first of all, we're going to Kerala in India. I suppose just to give some of the reasoning for that, over the past 6 years, sort of in developing Minerva, I've kind of developed an increasing interest in India and what's happening in Indian higher education. And going back to when I first visited in 2017, I was sort of immediately struck by the fact that there's an appetite and an opportunity and a space for innovation there. Which it's not obvious that it's easy for us in the UK to enjoy at the moment. And, you know, and I think we kind of all understand the challenges around the burden of regulation, which the sector has at the moment. But also, I think in India, there's this sense of, you know, how on earth are we going to deal with the fact that we've got 600 million people under the age of 25? And a huge and rapidly growing demand for higher education. So it struck me that sort of that would be an ideal location for trying to do something that was kind of quite different and quite bold. And then I sort of started to, as I started thinking about it, for a while it was called Preposterous University in my mind. I was thinking of, I kept on kind of, so Thomas More's Utopia was in the back of my mind as sort of, a ridiculous set of ideas that would be unfeasible. And as I thought about it more, I started trying to stress test some of the things I was thinking about, and hopefully I've ended up with something that isn't completely ridiculous, but we'll see.
So, I mean, that is a very bold and exciting venture. So let's be clear then. Are you marching in from the UK to set up your new university in Kerala? Or are you in fact an established or a newish Indian based university
and drawing on, you know, playing to an international market, but based in Kerala. So what's the backstory to the institution?
So I'm going to have to spend the next 5 years fundraising, I think, is the first thing I've got to say. And I think one of the things that is very common in India at the moment is there's a huge interest in, from successful business people in investing in higher education. You know, pretty much anybody who's anybody sets up their own university there these days. Working with partners, working with partners in India, probably partners in the UK, probably possibly even university partners, maybe a consortium, I don't know. But you would want to be bringing in a lot of people into the vision and into the project before you could get going, I think. And the proposition would be focused on a sort of widening participation initiative. But I think, again, this is as it's critical in the UK, it's also critical in India. And the government policy there has a very strong emphasis on bringing in people into higher education from underrepresented backgrounds, but that's at the level of gender or kind of just underrepresented parts of Indian society.
So is it a distinctive university in India then?
It changed its name from preposterous university to, because I think one of the things about India is that you need to be very blunt about what you're selling and what you're doing. So it changed its name to Kerala Leadership University, which is not to say that it's interested in only leaders, but I think there's a sort of principle behind everything, which is preparing people for kind of taking on leadership or becoming leaders. And some of the things I thought about the degree programs is, you would ideally have the first, if it's a 3-year program or a 4-year program, not completely sure, but you would ideally have the first half of it be the KLU degree, and it would be very broad based. It would include sciences, it would include liberal arts. In some ways, it would be an extremely traditional sort of degree that you might have done in the 16th or 17th century in Oxford. But with a modern take on the range of disciplines. But you would ideally have an idea that people go to university to learn about the universe, the first half of it would be about a kind of very broad enrichment. Everyone would do languages, everyone would do coding. How you'd fit it in, I don't know, but ideally it would be very, very broad, but detail, exactly. absolute priority on kind of collapsing disciplinary boundaries, very big focus on student-centered learning, with hopefully, and one of the things that I think the fundraising would be paying for in advance would be visiting faculty. I don't think that we would be looking for research from the start. I think we would be looking for the research leaders to come in and bring that additional value. Real kind of values, I think, behind the proposition of what we're trying to develop in the undergraduates. I think notions around resilience, confidence, critical thinking, ethics, and values would be very central. I think something around without, I don't want to, again, it's a kind of cul-de-sac I don't necessarily want to go into, but something around the sort of freedom of speech and understanding different ideologies, and actually moving away from what seems to me to be increasingly a sort of tit for tat around different ideologies and perspectives to actually a sort of more holistic view of, it's kind of okay for people to have different views. Of course, something around entrepreneurship and supporting entrepreneurship, I think, is going to be key in the degree programs. And then I think in the second half of the degree, you encourage people to focus and specialize, because it can't be so distinctive that, everybody looks at graduates and thinks, what the hell are you going to do with these kids? So I think to start off with, you have to go for sort of sensible frameworks of disciplines that could be translated to the external world. So business, technology, law, maybe, I thought might be the first kind of three specialisms you might have in the second half of the degree.
So that's really, I think it's a really interesting configuration. One thing I'm just trying to grasp at here is, right, so you've got this widening participation agenda, really important, right? But part the way you've described it as well also makes it sound, you know, well, frankly, quite elitist. But also quite small and boutique, right? So in terms of scale, then, what are you thinking of in terms of the scale of the institution? Almost also sounds a bit like a kind of Indian Sorbonne. You know, it's like you're, you know, a kind of finishing school for national leaders.
Yeah, I mean, so one of the universities that I love in India is called ITS Mohan Nagar, and it's in a town called Ghaziabad, which is just north of Delhi. And it's a kind of non-profit kind of private institution, and they actively go out into the slums on Saturdays, and in fact existing undergraduates go out into the slums to kind of do outreach to the kids in the slums, and then they have a kind of commitment that a proportion of their undergraduates then come from those backgrounds, there's something that's kind of quite striking about it. So they also have a principle, which is that to make it clear that they're all on the same footing, they all wear a uniform. So it's very kind of regimented in the way that it feels, but it does mean that you can't tell who comes from the very wealthy backgrounds and who comes from the normal backgrounds. And I'm not suggesting there'd be a uniform, although it would be fun to imagine what that might look like. I think a big chunk of what the money from the fundraising would be spent on is trying to seriously make sure that 50% of the undergraduates come from disadvantaged backgrounds, and that you're avoiding it being that kind of finishing school for the rich.
But you're painting a really lovely picture here, but I'm imagining, you know, quite a, you know, a really high quality set of facilities in some kind of lush, subtropical, paradisical campus with beautiful residential accommodation for people from whatever background. Is that how you see it, or is it slightly different from that?
And maybe this would be something which would be distinctive in the Indian context. I mean, you tend there to have either very, very humble facilities, or you have the kind of glitziest and most modern. I mean, for example, if you visit the Geo Institute in Mumbai now, for their journalism courses, they have facilities which are kind of probably as good as anything that any kind of globally leading media company has. And I think you'd want something in between. I think you'd want to deliberately not look like it's about the money and the glitz. I thought about the buildings a bit, and I think you'd have to think that through really carefully. I think that because you want the estates to tell you something about the purpose and the mission of the institution. You want it to be uplifting, but it absolutely wouldn't be playing into the kind of American business school kind of model of people who visited the campus, you'd want them to go away feeling that they were part of a really exciting project for socially motivated leadership, but you wouldn't want them go away thinking, oh my god, I'm effing amazing, you know, look at me kind of thing.
Let me not put words into your mouth, but I'm imagining therefore the kind of campus facilities you're describing or imagining are much more focused on that community rather than have, you know, a lazy river, a climbing wall, and, you know, the most luxurious catering outlets you could imagine.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's much more grounded than that, I would say.
And unlike the Infosys headquarters in India, you wouldn't have it spelling out KLU if you looked at it from the air.
No, absolutely not. I don't think that would be the case.
Good. Well, just checking, you know.
And you asked about scale as well. I mean, I think the reality is these things have got to start small, haven't they?
Yeah.
Maybe if it's a successful model, you have multiple campuses in different locations, but you retain a sense of the intimacy in small scale. The big stress test is around affordability, isn't it? But let's put that to one side.
But given that your donors are rolling in to support this vision for the Kerala Leadership University, then you won't have a problem, will you?
And the other thing I thought about as well is that so one of I thought about a master's degree maybe as well, a KLU master's degree, which I mean we all know the world needs a new MBA, and I think in fact I haven't thought this through at the level that I really should have done before bringing it up, but I was thinking actually in some ways if you had a master's degree that was aimed at people who really did have 10 to 15 years experience, really did want to come and have an educational postgraduate experience that enabled them to think through at a deeper level, kind of, you know, what sort of contribution could they make, and how, then if you've got the right people on that course, not only could a proportion of them be paying quite hefty fees, you know, which would be good for the income of the institution, but also they could be involved in course delivery and things like that for the undergraduates. They could be mentoring, they could be helping, and you could be really kind of building out the community ethos.
I mean, it's a really nice idea, and I'm sure you would have other postgraduate provision as well. You said you wouldn't start with research, you'd focus on tea, but would you intend to grow the research profile of the institution?
I think we'd have to work. I think we'd have to wait until we'd have to ask ourselves that question 10 years, 15 years down the line. I think you know we would have to wait and see. I think it would be nice to have if you could. I suppose, like a lot of universities, the question would be: are there two or three areas where we're developing a degree of kind of expertise and understanding where we could make a contribution? And that would be the question, I think. But it wouldn't primarily be about the research; it would be about the ed educational experience, I think. I thought quite a lot as well about governance and staffing. And one of the things I'd like to start off with is you couldn't do this rigidly from the start, but I'd like to explore a possibility that there's no such thing as an academic and there's no such thing as a professional services staff member.
Ooh.
You know, which in a sense, and I suppose I'm thinking of professional service firms. Where you know if you're the partner in a law firm, for example, or at least if you take the partnership of a large law firm, you have people who they have the technical expertise, but they're also expected to be involved in the marketing. You know, they're expected to become involved in the human resources or the even the kind of financial planning. So you have, and of course you can't. You do need people to kind of help with running the place, but I wouldn't want any academics in the institution to not be interested in getting their hands dirty and being part of the corporate life of the institution. And yeah, but I think that could work with this university because really, it wouldn't be so important to me that everybody's got a PhD than that they have a demonstrable passion for the development of the students, that they're articulate and able to kind of teach, and that they're sort of, you know, they're motivated by the vision and looking to the future somehow.
So that's a really interesting idea about about that kind of staff base. But does that mean then that when you say, academic colleagues getting their hands dirty, I'm assuming you don't literally mean that you're going to, you know, everyone's going to take it in turns to work on the grounds, or just mean about everyone participating in an appropriate way in the life of the university.
Yeah, I agree. And in the same way that you know, you get some vice chancellor now saying, you know, we do teaching research and enterprise, and you know, in 10 years time I want every academic to be kind of doing well in two of those. The fourth thing you'd add would be something around the kind of, I don't know, for want of a less drab way of putting it, kind of organizational development or something, you know, and so that it would just be expected that that would be part of people's engagement with the institution, and gone would be that culture of, you know, heads of department saying, oh, this isn't my problem, this is HR's problem, sort of thing, and you know.
So in a sense, then, everyone is living the leadership ethos of of the university contractually as well as on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. And actually, if, you know, why not, if they wanted to help with the gardening? I mean, that could probably be quite a good for the well-being of the staff. So.
University allotments, there's plenty of them. Okay, right. So. You know, it's still new, right? But you've got ambitions to grow potentially to other leagues. But and, you know, research will happen in due course. But I mean, what's your attitude towards, you know, the bane of modern university life, which is university league tables, right? You know, in India there is kind of fetishization of rankings. So so how do you play in that space?
It's a really big problem. I mean, you know, this kind of reverse takeover of the higher education sector by the rankings industry of the past 25 years has been so unwholesome. And the way that it now becomes a critical instrument of governance, you know, enabling lay members of boards to find a shortcut to understanding what's going on in the institution, but which is a very, very kind of brutally simplistic measure of what universities are about has been terrible. That is tricky. It's tricky because one of the really interesting propositions for India is what if they were to ask the question, let's define good differently. Let's say, I mean, in facetious terms, I suppose you can argue that the rankings are essentially about replicating, you know, Oxford, Harvard and Cambridge, you know, at the top end. And what if they were to say, okay, so let's forget all of that and ask ourselves the questions, what kind of institution does India need, or what kind of, you know, even more broadly, what kind of universities does the world need now, and how might they be different from what we have? You know, then the last thing you would want is a ranking system that kind of is based around idealizing a model which is somewhere between 150 and 500 years old. I sort of feel at some point for credibility, you're going to have to end up participating in that game somehow. But you probably the key to success here is getting the right engagement from the right funders, you know, who are employing lots of graduates and who are interested, who are feeling that there's a shortfall that the graduates they're employing could be better than the ones they're currently getting, and they could be broader and more bring more depth, I suppose, which is what the university would be aiming for. And I think that their support would be critical to get through those years where you would be sticking two fingers up at the ranking system.
Yeah, and it's even if you wanted to play the game, it would take you quite a bit of time to get to a place where you could actually meaningfully contribute. But I think you're, you know, looking to use the support of your funders, looking to boost your reputation through delivery in other modes, but also ensuring that if you were able to continue successfully to recruit students because of the attractiveness of your offer, you don't really lose out hugely by not playing in the rankings, at least in the short term, it seems to me.
Yeah.
The medium long term decision is something that you would have to come back to, I think. And it would link to your ambitions in terms of research, because the international rankings do depend heavily on research profile.
I thought about governance as well. So one of the first challenges with this model is how do you keep the problem with private universities, particularly when the donors, corporate donors, is they then see them as a toy. And so, first of all, you've got to have a really kind of clear delineation between the funders who would sit on an advisory board and real governance. And maybe you would have some sort of participatory involvement from the advisory board in the main university council or whatever. But essentially, and that would, to my mind, that would be a proper unitary board. It would be probably 40-45% executives and 50-55% lay people. There would be no sense of this sort of we're the lay governors and we're here to kind of slap your wrists and look over your shoulder. It would be much more of a, how do we work together to deliver the strategy safely? And I think that would be kind of quite an important distinction about the institution. And then you would try and have a really holistic model of a Senate as well, which was as unruly as it could possibly be, where people really felt comfortable bringing voices forward. You would also, because one of the things I still think is intriguing, and people keep telling me that I shouldn't be intrigued by this, is why Senates are so kind of, why Senates are so sort of regulated in a way. I mean, it's one of the best means by which the leadership of an institution can communicate and talk to the and listen to and hear from the broader community of the institution. But yet there's so often a sort of thing said, well, of course, the statutes say that this is really just about assessing quality across the institution or safeguarding quality. And it seems to me that you would actually want to embrace a Senate which was as broad based as possible and as engaged as possible.
But if your ambition is to have meaningful engagement and communication with the university body, right, you wouldn't design that through the vehicle of a Senate, would you? Right.
I suppose you wouldn't call it a Senate, and it wouldn't be the same. These are the names I haven't thought through. I mean, I was thinking this morning as well. We wouldn't have a job title called Vice Chancellor. I don't know what you'd replace it with, but. I certainly wouldn't be the vice chancellor. I think you'd have, whether you'd even just have a partnership model. I mean, it wouldn't be legally a partnership model, but whether those would be the sort of titles you'd go for, I don't know.
Oh, well, right. OK.
Changing
we
the
need
subject.
We need some consultative forum, right, or engaging forum, right, which may or may not be modelled on a traditional Senate or some other means. You'll come up with something.
Let's call that the engagement forum for now.
Right. I'm sure you'll come up with a better name. But let's come to the heart of this issue, right? You, Professor Tucker, are not vice chancellor of this university that you're designing, right? So you want some kind of loose communitarian collective. So how's that actually working?
I don't know. I speak as somebody who's building an organization where we have a kind of 50-50 split, and we don't have a clue who's responsible for what. But yet it works really well. I can't believe that we need to be so wedded to the idea that we need heroes and heroines, who have to work in isolation in that way. I mean, it's probably a partnership of three or four. I think you probably do need some delineation between you clearly need one who is a sort of chief academic officer. You clearly need one who is focused on kind of fundraising and external engagement. I'm making this as up as I go along, by the way. And you probably need one which is kind of organizationally focused. But then you'd probably sit down and look at the job descriptions and you'd say, okay, we need to be a bit more playful with that. And so, you know, you would make sure that the chief academic officer still had to think about some of the organizational issues, still had to be involved in the external representation, and kind of you'd have to find a way of making it so that they couldn't, you could never untie any of those people from each other. And you would just accept the fact that the inefficiencies that came from that would lead to the creative benefit, would be for the creative benefit of the institution.
It's a novel idea, I'll give you that, but I mean, triumvirates haven't always, you know, come to happy ends in the history of organizations or indeed nations. But yeah, you know, part of your rationale must be it's a different kind of institution with a different ethos, a different way of working, right? You want different governance structures, then, you know, why not have different leadership and management structures? You're meant to be breaking new ground, you know, you're trying to be a novel kind of provider. So, you know, why not?
I don't know how you would regulate it, but, and maybe this would be one of the kind of key roles of the board or a senior independent board member, would be helping the leadership manage their egos. You know, this institution isn't going to work if anybody gets carried away with themselves and starts to enjoy status.
And so it's going to be a pretty hair-shirty environment, is it?
Actually, I wouldn't say hair shirty. I'd say it would be very kind of generous and warm community. But, you know, if anybody who lost a sense of leadership as being about service wouldn't be welcome, I think. That would be time to move on. They can go back to the mainstream sector.
In the nicest possible way. Can we go back to students who may or may not be wearing uniforms, which, you know, obviously you want to reflect on further. But, and, you know, you've got a diversity of student body because, as you say, you're bringing in people from, you know, the most disadvantaged backgrounds, as well as those who can afford to pay through the nose for this experience. And, you know, you're creating a very kind of equalizing, egalitarian kind of environment for them, which I think is absolutely laudable. But what other elements of the kind of student community experience are there? Is there anything distinctive about the nature of the student experience at KLU?
There would be a really strong dedication to the kind of community of the institution. One of the really interesting conversations I had with the Vice Chancellor in India recently was, this vice chancellor had been doing a kind of town hall meeting with the student community. And it started off with questions around, we want flood lighting for the cricket pitch so we can practice at nighttime and opening hours of the library. And then it moved on to condoms. And there was this, basically the students were saying, actually, we need free condoms. Because we're using them more than once, and Amazon deliveries are taking quite a long time. One of the things I'm nervous about with some of the debates around life and universities at the moment is about the responsibility for 18 for adults, basically. And
yeah,
I think sort of like a lot of public debates, we're kind of forced into a sort of knee-jerk situation once something happens, you know, and kind of our universities in loco parentis or not, you know, and are 18-year-olds able to look after themselves or not? And I think somehow you would want in the culture of the institution to be very light touch about it, but very clear also that, you know, the people in the university community are responsible for themselves. It's not to say that you wouldn't provide free condoms, but that, you know, this the institution would be about enabling people and helping them to develop their resourcefulness and things like that. And we would be avoiding getting into some of the more challenging territory. I don't know how easy it would be to avoid, really, in the modern world, but...
Part of the traditional idea of, and certainly in the UK, and we're going back a bit, is, you know, universities as a space in which, you know, 18-year-olds, and it was generally 18-year-olds, you know, had a kind of protected space in which they could mature and they could make mistakes and they could learn from those mistakes in a way which was in some way, you know, supported but also protected them from the, you know, the harsh realities of life. But there is for me still an element of truth in that, in that you want students to be able to make the most of all the advantages and all the opportunities that a university provides for them, but you also want to ensure that they're able to do so safely and securely, and they don't have to worry about some of those things, you know, like money, like having a, you know, a decent roof over their head, and like being, you know, secure in the relationships with their peers, that they might have to do, which would distract them from all the core activities they need to do.
Yeah.
So there is still something about providing the right environment for people to mature and learn in together.
In some ways, maybe what I'm trying to say is actually quite a traditional idea of university life from that point of view. Like, it's really, really important to me that the students leave feeling confident and that they've got the resources to thrive when they kind of go out into the world. And I'm not sure that, I think some of it is a resourcing problem now. I think it's actually the, you know, we're facing such a big challenge with mental health in particular that, you know, it's more or less impossible for institutions to work out how to respond to that. I mean, questions around, would it be an open access campus? I don't know, probably. I think it would be. You know, you'd make sure it's in the right sort of place where that could work with the local community and where you could be seen as contributing. Somewhere like Kochi, for example, would be a lovely place to have it. You could link in with the art festivals and so on. The other thing, technology, I think, is important, isn't it? And I think, I think, you know, we would not seek to do online delivery. For us, it would be, I mean, I started off by talking about how coding would be part of every undergraduate degree, and definitely that sort of those technological expertise is going to be really important for the graduates. But we would be much more interested in the experience of members of the community apprehending each other physically face to face, and for us, technology would be in its place, you know, and wouldn't be banning phones or anything like that, but you would be getting people away from, you know, communicating at the level of texts and encouraging, again, probably quite traditional values about humans interacting with each other, I think.
But that's a very noble aspiration, right? You mentioned bans there, right? Well, let me ask you, you know, bearing in mind that you do have a degree of freedom here in terms of what you create as a university, it is imaginary. You're not banning phones, but are there things you are banning at your university? I mean, you know, you don't have to ban it. It could be entirely free and laissez-faire, but are you banning anything?
So I think what we'll do with that, just for the fun of it, is we'll let the kind of student guild decide once a term what they want to ban, you know, and they can choose because in a sense, most bans in institutional environments are concerned with the students, and it would be interesting to test out, you know, what would self-governing look like that from that point of view.
Termly rotating bans selected by the students themselves.
Yeah, and if something really important came up that needed to last more than a term, I guess you could deal with that. But I mean, I'm not, you know, I'm not naturally the kind of person to ban anything, so. It's not my nature particularly.
Okay, that's fair enough. That's fair enough. Are there any other
I
as we
suppose,
kind of
I mean, I suppose we should, I mean, I suppose we should, I suppose I should caveat that by saying illegal activities would be banned.
but they're against the law, so we're not, you know, we're not
Yeah.
saying you got a mascot then. You've not got a mascot.
It would have to, I mean, the mascot would have to be related to the sea or to fishing, or you know, whether you'd go for a kind of a big shell or something like that.
A big
Something.
shell is a bit dull, isn't
Okay, let's have, I don't know,
it?
an elephant maybe, but I mean again
Bit dubious, isn't it?
it's a bit predictable, isn't it?
Yeah. And then you come under pressure to have one on campus and to name it, and then you get into all sorts of challenges. And then your alumni donors will want to have a whip round to buy a new elephant every year. You know, so yeah, you probably don't want to go there. So
I mean,
maybe a
actually,
shell is
just as
probably the
you're
best.
actually just as you're just as we're talking about that, I'm sort of thinking about actually one of the things I didn't talk about with the attraction of Kerala is, you know, it is a very, very left-leaning government in Kerala, and it's a government which is investing a lot in higher education and taking it really seriously, and it's far enough out of sight and out of mind from Delhi that it's not a state that kind of gets a lot of pressure to get to come in line, and so it would be, to my mind, the right place to, you know, to try and set up something like this, which is, you know, trying to be as far away as possible from sort of capricious twists of government policy, and that made me think about mascots. Maybe you'd have like, maybe you would have, going back to a quadrumvirate of, you know, socialist leaders or something like that. You know, you could have a kind of a day where you celebrated, I don't know, Karl Marx and people like that, Cabral. The trouble is, yeah, also located in the Indian culture, which will come on when we talk about the music, because I think that's
Well,
challenging.
and I think that, you know, the more you politicize it, the more you run the risk of narrowing your
It
potential.
is true. That is true. And of course, we've got corporate donors who are not going to be happy with all the students dressing up as Karl Marx one day a year.
With a big beard.
And what does Karl Marx mean in India anyway?
Well, it's another challenge for your for that quadrumvirate to grapple with, or
It's
your
true.
board. Okay, let's come then to the final thing is what is the music? What is the university song? What is the tune that gets the university going at graduation time and everyone rallies round?
So, this is a really difficult question. I think the Indian context makes it difficult because what I've discovered is they know some, I mean, I only really know Western music, and they know some Western music really, really well, and some they don't know at all. And I discovered this at a conference in Goa where we were doing karaoke, and they agreed that they could play Ring of Fire by Johnny Cash, and I was about to sing it, and they started playing a Lionel Richie song instead. And sort of then trying to explain to them why there was really no overlap at all between Lionel Richie and Johnny Cash. And also I didn't know any Lionel Richie songs was kind of difficult. So I mean, purely out of personal choice, I think for fun, what you would do is you'd probably have three or four pieces of music, and they would be pumped out across campus at different times of day. So in the morning, you would, for me, I'd go for the Devo corporate anthem, you know, which is sort of kind of peculiarly regimented, uplifting, you know, and you know, I could imagine standing with the fellow partners on the balcony saluting the sunrise every day with the Devo corporate anthem playing. And then the other tune I'd love to have, and this is something actually I haven't talked about enough, which is that I think somehow if you're if you've got an ethos in the institution which is about resourcefulness, you also need to be encouraging people to embrace failure and accept that if you want to succeed, you kind of have to have the courage to fail and I suppose I'm speaking personally as well, from setting up a business, you kind of at some point you turn around and actually start to enjoy failing because you realize that it's kind of part of succeeding and you kind of get over the fear of it. And so the tune I'd go to, which is actually not about failure because it's actually about drinking, is Tub Thumping. But I still think that kind of, you access it on the basis of I get knocked down, get up again. But you would particularly want the cover version that They Might Be Giants did of it. And that would be, I think that would be the graduation tune, really. I get knocked down, but I get up again.
Is it a non-drinking campus, by the way? Because that might be slightly troublesome. We haven't really banned alcohol, so we're okay.
It would be really, really hard for me to implement a non-drinking campus.
Excellent. And I noticed you've been very restrained in not putting any of your own music there, because it would be a great royalties opportunity.
Engaging with my music is, I would never force on anybody. That has to be a voluntary activity.
Ben, we need to stop there. But listen, thank you ever so much for your time and sharing all of your thoughts for your wonderful imaginary university in Kerala. It's been a roller coaster ride through an exciting higher education establishment. It's certainly very novel, very interesting, and I'm sure it would be enormously attractive and successful, despite miniature failures, were it ever to take place. So thank you ever so much for your time.
Thank you.
I do hope you enjoyed this edition of My Imaginary University. There should be more episodes along soon. In the meantime, you might like to listen to the equally higher education focused podcast, University Registrars Talking About Stuff, in which I talk to senior university leaders, most of them registrars or equivalent, about their careers and various bits of HE stuff. Just Google it to find many interesting episodes to listen to.